Joseph. I see you eyeballing me over there. All right. 21:20. Just a good reminder of his life and where we're going to go. 21:20. Somebody read that.
Precious treasure and oil are in a wise man's dwelling, but a foolish man devours it.
All right, so precious treasure and oil, those are both things, obviously, that are of great value. Treasure being money, oil being something as a resource. And this guy has the ability to save and to accumulate things in a godly way that are of value. The fool, the opposite of that, is someone who swallows up all their wealth. Now, this may be a bad example. Solomon is a guy, obviously, that had a ton. He saved a ton. He got a ton from ill-gotten gain that we'll see this morning as to how he acquired a lot of his wealth. And it is insane, the amount of wealth that he has. It's unfathomable how much money this guy has. But I think for you and I, in the context that we live in, and I don't know, maybe something about me turning this last year or 2 years ago 40, I feel like I remember being at my mom's 40th birthday party. For those of you guys that like remember those moments and just thinking, golly, you are so old, like the black balloons, right, and all that stuff. And there's just something about feeling like you're kind of cresting the hill and now you're coming down the backside of it, where you start thinking through, gosh, yeah, one day I'd like to retire, and one day I'd like to, you know, have the ability to make different decisions and be financially in a place where we can do that. And if I want to work less or work for free or whatever, or do what I want to do. And so just the idea of beginning to plan for the future, not that we haven't, but just the idea of it, man, it is coming faster than it ever has, with, you know, a daughter that's about to start driving in June, 3 college tuitions and 3 weddings, Lord willing. And like, all right, everybody's getting married in our backyard, and we'll have punch and cake. So anyway, as you guys think through life, and as I'm maybe in a season just thinking about that more than normal, part of godly qualities is the ability to save and the ability to steward well what you have. And I know we probably beat this horse good and dead around here, but make sure that you guys, in your stage of life, especially for those of you that are younger, are practicing those disciplines now of giving off the top, of saving a certain portion of your money, and then living off the remainder. And if you develop those habits now and can adhere to those, then you will never struggle with this. You don't want to get in a place where you're wrestling with finances at the end of your life, where you realize you squandered them early on. Okay, and we're going to see someone in Solomon that had excess and still squandered it all. So because he pursued ultimately the wrong thing. So don't let that be an idol in the midst of it. Money is a great thing. It's a tool, but it's not the end all be all. So, all right, so just a note on that before we get into Solomon. All right, 1 Kings, Juan. Before we get there, I want to hand out these. So just take one down, pass it around. So this is your Kings chart. I know that stuff is microscopic. It is in Dropbox. So if you want a non-microscopic view of this chart, that I think it's in like 8-point font. Can I have one of those, by the way? I'm sorry. I always give all of them out. Don't get I have this one in front of me, but not getting up.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to get up.
All right. So let me just walk you guys through what you're seeing here and where we're going to go. So I wanted to give you a bit of a roadmap, if you will, where 1st and 2nd Kings and Ezra and Nehemiah and Lord willing and the creek don't rise, maybe Esther will take us, but no promises on Esther. She's great, just not sure we're going to get there. So at the very, very top of your chart, you see the 3 kings of the United Monarchy, Saul, David, and Solomon, okay? They are called the United Monarchy because that is the only time in Israel's history that the kingdom is united together. You see next to their names, each has a heart. Saul's is black, David's is red, and Solomon's is black and red. Okay, the idea being Saul had no heart for God, David had a heart for God, Solomon had a divided heart for God. And we'll see kind of that play out. Okay, that is the story of 1 and 2 Samuel. So just to kind of intro where we're headed with the kings, obviously they don't get a ton of land on this chart, if you will, but wanted this you guys to see how it intros in. Each of those guys reign again for 40 years, And then at 931, underneath Solomon, the kingdom is going to split under him. Okay, 1 Kings 12, when we get there, we're going to see why this happens and why we go from a divide or a united monarchy to a divided monarchy. Okay, these are big picture dates, by the way, that would be good for you to remember. 931 is one that I would remember if I were you and I wrote the final. So I would remember it. Okay? 931. Right underneath Solomon's name, you guys see that 931? BC? Okay, that's your date. These are all BC, in case you guys weren't sure. Yes. 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 For sure, okay? In the north, to the right-hand side of your chart, you see Israel, okay, 10 tribes. And then on the south is Judah, which is the two tribes, which is obviously the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, because they're within Judah, are there. So as you think through kind of where the lay of the land's going to be, 10 tribes north, 2 tribes south. A lot of this should be reviewed, so it should feel familiar to you guys. Okay, in the north, you'll notice all the kings, all 19 of them, are evil. Okay, so hence black, dark hearts. Okay, there are no godly kings in Israel for the entirety of that reign, all the way up to, you'll see in 722 BC, the box, that kind of reddish, maroonish box at the bottom right, the destruction of the northern kingdom by Assyria in 722 BC. They are going to get deported into Assyria, and we'll see that towards the end of 2 Kings and how that happens. But all of them, to a man, do not walk with God. They are evil to a man, okay? In the south, we have 20 kings, okay? There are a few blips of hope on the radar. You'll see some are all blue, like Asa, third one down, and Jehoshaphat after them, meaning, man, they're solid kings. They have good hearts. I don't know why I chose blue. I just did. I like blue. So blue it is. So they have solid hearts, walk with God. And then there's guys like above him, the second king down on the left, Abijah, who starts good and ends bad. And then you have other kings like, where is it, Manasseh? Where did he go? Yeah. Towards the bottom, he reigns longer than any other king. 55 years, by the way, starts bad and ends good. And that color code probably isn't quite right. There should be about 5% blue and 95% black in Manasseh. He is incredibly wicked evil. And then, like, Jeffrey Dahmer has a deathbed confession and decides to walk with God. And it's one of those guys you're like, really? Like, I'm not sure that I want you to be saved. That type of guy, okay? So we're about to get into this chart, and you're about to get overwhelmed with names, okay? First and Second Kings particularly feels like you're drinking from a fire hydrant. It's just so much information, okay? Take it in stride. What I want you guys to see is the big picture, and there'll be some stories that you'll remember in whatever, which are great, but don't get bogged down in all the details, okay? So we're not going to ask you what's the ninth king in the tribe of Judah. That's not our point with any of this in the text, okay? But I do want you guys to understand big picture movements, and if I asked you, hey, could you name, like, one or two kings in the north? Could you do that? Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, that would be good. But don't worry about all the details. That's why I gave you guys a chart, so when you revisit kings hopefully later in your life, you can remember this stuff, okay? So those are the big pictures left and right, okay? And then in the midst of that, kind of down the middle, you see a couple different things. One are these like orangey, what color is that? Orangish, I have a box of 8 crayons in my head, and that color is not on there. I don't know what that is, okay? Orange-ish, okay? Marigold. So this is a woman. She is correct, okay? The marigold colors. You'll see these are the current world superpowers, okay? So Egypt starts, then we're going to go to Syria or Aram. We're going to meet some of their kings. So there's 3 different kings that we'll see in the story of the kings, 2 Kings. Then it moves to Assyria, then Egypt again, Babylon, and then finally Persia, okay? So just as you think through, who is Israel up against in different seasons? These are the current foes, if you will, the major foes of the land that control the rest of the known world, for lack of a better word. Okay, and then we're also going to meet prophets, Elijah and Elisha, the 2 major prophets in 1 and 2 Kings that are there, placed by God, to try to turn the nation's heart back to the Lord. It works better in the south than it does in the north, okay, but we'll see that. And then in that box down there that says key dates in the middle, these are some dates that I would like for you guys to remember. These are important. Not all of them, but a couple of them. Obviously, I mentioned 931 BC, where the kingdom divides. The Assyrian captivity of 722, that's when the northern tribes get deported into Assyria. Following that is the Babylonian captivity. The Babylonian captivity is of the south in 586 BC. There's three different movements of that captivity, if you will. It doesn't happen all at once. It occurs over time. The end of it all is actually in 586 BC. That's the date that I want you guys to remember. And that is when the temple that Solomon's about to build today gets destroyed. Okay, so Solomon's going to build this monstrosity of a temple. It'll be in service for 400 or 500 years, and it's going to get destroyed by the Babylonians, and God predicts it. He tells Solomon when he builds it, listen, if you walk with God, this thing will stand forever, as will your line. However, if you don't walk with God, there will not be a stone of this temple that's not left unturned. We'll destroy it all, and I'll kick all of y'all out of the land. Just like, by the way, he predicted to Moses. You guys remember that when they went in the promised land and God whispers in Moses' ears and is like, they're all going to disobey. I'm going to kick them all out anyway. Okay? But he says, Solomon, man, if you'll walk with me, this can work. If you don't, then so be it. Okay? So 586 BC and 722 BC, respectively, those are good dates to hang on to. And then we're going to have three different guys that are going to lead the returns back into the land. So Israel basically gets the boot from the land. Some of them will stay, and I'll walk you guys through how that process works, but the vast majority of the people get spread everywhere. Some in Babylon, some in Persia, some in Assyria, and then there's a couple of guys that pick up their Bible and read and find out if they repent that God will let them come back into the land. Okay, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel. Okay, so the book of Ezra obviously contains Ezra's story as well as Zerubbabel, and then Nehemiah with Nehemiah. Okay, and those guys are going to rebuild the people. They're going to rebuild the temple, the second temple, since the first one that Solomon made was destroyed. And then Nehemiah is going to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem and create, basically, safety. Okay? So that, in a nutshell, is your handy-dandy chart. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Why is it South and Benjamin?
Judah's in the south, the region of the south. It's called Judah, which is the tribe of Judah. Because Benjamin is stuck geographically in the middle of Judah, they get incorporated into that as well. So they are the two tribes that go to the south, Benjamin and Judah. The other 10 tribes go to the north and are loyal to the northern king. Okay, and basically it's a geographical divide. It's just how Israel works, and the plateaus and wadis and such that are in the land create that divide. Make sense? And then you've got, obviously, the Levites that are kind of scattered all over the place. And we don't hear a lot from them during this time. It's a dark, dark day. Okay? Again, it's a lot of information, but the good news is it never changes. Okay? So it's going to be this way forever, which is good. But it'll be good for you guys to come back and reference and maybe hang on to a couple kings. For those of you that are teachers that just have opportunities, these are gold. Okay? Nobody's ever taught them before. They have never heard these stories in their life. So you can be terrible. It's going to be the best story of Uzziah they have ever heard, because they don't know who Uzziah is. And there's some life nuggets and wisdom in some of these kings that are off the chart. Okay, these are some of the messages that, as I started teaching as an early communicator, that I just tucked away in my back pocket and knew if somebody asked in 15 minutes, I could open my Bible and I could teach a little bit about this king with a story that would hit home for a junior high student. Or whatever it may be. Okay, so there's just nuggets of wisdom in here, and we just don't mine these areas of the text very often, so that's why I want you guys to be somewhat familiar with it. Okay? It's taken me the better part of a decade to feel like I can finally get my hands around this text, where I'm like, I think I kind of understand it for the most part. Okay? But it's a lot there. So don't get overwhelmed in the details. Keep your head above the waterline. All right? Any questions about that chart before we kind of move forward? Okay. 1 Kings. I'm in 2 Kings. We don't want to go there yet. 1 Kings 1. Let's pick up there. Tiana, will you pray for us before we get in, and then we will dive back in? Thanks. All right. So obviously we finished up 2 Samuel before the break. We saw kind of the writing on the wall with David, right? With at the end of 2 Samuel chapter 24 and 23, where he does the census was a bad thing. God rebukes him. We're seeing trouble in the land, but we see some amazing heart of David, if you will, with his offerings, with him buying the Temple Mount, the land that was there. And as we now move into 1 Kings, we study most of chapter 1, we see a dying David. He is literally on his deathbed, and he's going to die quickly. What do we see that was going on with David? More of the same in terms of his, maybe one of his fatal flaws, if you will. What was the issue that's causing chaos in 1 Kings? Yeah, he doesn't name a successor to the throne, right? So it's supposed to be who?
Solomon,
right? So we know that. We obviously have read the history, and maybe at this point they aren't as sure. But a guy by the name of Adonijah, one of David's sons, steps up and says, I'm going to take the throne. And it's believed now with the death of Absalom and Amnon that maybe this guy is the eldest surviving son, so it would have been natural for him to take the throne. So whether that was a usurping of authority or a coup or just a natural like, well, I guess I'm the next son around and David hasn't said anything, he's the guy that tries to take the throne, okay? So he throws his own party, we see in chapter 1. He grabs, by the way, Joab, David's old military commander that we saw in verse 7, Abiathar the priest, and they help him try to ascend to the throne. Nathan the prophet in verse 11 in chapter 1 comes to David and says, man, you need to make this right. You need to declare your intentions. So we see him as well as Bathsheba, who is Solomon's mom, come to David and say, man, you need to declare what your wishes are. The kingdom is basically in chaos. So David finally does that. In verse 30, says, your son Solomon shall be king after me. He anoints him, sends him out with Zadok the priest in verse 34, parade him before Israel, right, and make sure that his wishes are known. So Adonijah, the king that tries to raise up against Solomon, David's probably third eldest son, and Solomon are at odds. Solomon is in his wisdom as this guy flees for his life after his party comes to a hasty end, says, man, I don't want to kill you. I won't kill you. Go home. Live in your house. We're fine as long as you aren't a ding-dong. So as long as there's no more coups and that you don't seek to have the throne, man, we're going to be fine. So Solomon ends the end of 1 Kings, or 1 Kings chapter 1, I should say, with security of the throne, clarity from David. And chapter 2, moving forward, David is now going to give his deathbed speech. And this is pretty powerful. I want guys specifically for you to think through this through the lens of dad to son and how powerful this moment would have been for Solomon. For all of David's faults, he does this right. This is amazing what he communicates to his boy, okay? Jordan, pick up there in chapter 2, verse 1, if you don't mind.
As David's time to die drew near, he charged Solomon his son, saying, I am going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do wherever you turn.
All right, pause there for a second. So I love the fact he just calls him to be a man, right? Solomon is 21, by the way. David took the throne at 30, finally. So he's a young guy. We're going to see kings that are younger than him moving forward. One guy's 8, which is a disaster, right? You can only imagine a king, an 8-year-old king, a second grader. But Solomon's a young guy. He's 21. Man, he's a junior in college. And he's going to take over Israel. And his dad has done, for the most part, a pretty good job of establishing this nation. And he says, man, Solomon, you can't be a boy any longer. You need to step up and you need to be a man. And Solomon is, but that's the charge. And then David's going to define, what do I mean by manhood? I don't mean drive fast cars, chase pretty girls, drink a lot of beer. This is not what it is to be a man. David communicates what it is to be a guy that is a real dude. And what do you see there in verse 3? What is at the core of this? Being a man. Walk with God. That's what it is to be a man, right? That's part of the core definition. Okay, and onward in 4, You do these things, you walk with God, keep his ordinances, follow what is written in the law of Moses, i.e. Solomon, read your Bible, know what God wants of you, so that in verse 4, the Lord may carry out his promise, which he spoke concerning me. If your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. So what is David at the very end of his life thinking about? What matters to him? Yeah, legacy, descendants, and not the house that David said he was going to build for God, right? God, I'm going to build you a fat house. And God says, no, David, I'm going to build you a house. This is what matters to David at the end of his life, his legacy. David's going to be gone, and he wants to make sure that there's something that remains after he is gone. And a physical house is not what David is after. Now, we're going to see a physical house coming, obviously, but that's not ultimately what he had in mind. He is concerned about legacy. And as you guys age and as we talk to old folks, this is what they care about. They stop pursuing folks that are at least trying to walk with God. Money and fame and riches, that's not the stuff that matters. You realize, man, I'm going to die. And in some time, if I have not invested my life in stuff that's going to be here after me, then my life has been wasted. The Word of God and the souls of men are the only things that are going to be around after you and I are dead. And to the extent which you invest in those as a man or a woman is the extent to which your legacy will be left. And David's saying, in Solomon, you are my legacy. Don't screw this up, because I want to see not just you, but grandsons and so on leading Israel in this regard, in godliness and that sort of thing. Okay, so really cool just to see him saying, walk with God. And then watch what he does. He's going to give him some instructions as to, hey, here's some unfinished business that you get to deal with because of my reign as a king. But it's fascinating the way he does it, okay? Jordan, keep rolling, in verse 5, rather.
Now you also know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner, and to Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace. He put the blood of war on his belt, about his waist, and on the sandals of his feet.
All right, so he reminds him, hey, Joab is a marked man at this point. So I didn't deal with him, but Solomon, you're going to have to. Okay, keep rolling.
So act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace.
So David says, I need you to deal with Joab. How? So, potentially, we know what's going to happen. Joab is going to get murdered by Benaiah, who is Solomon's boy. But what does David specifically say in verse 6?
Don't let him die of old age.
What's it say? Part of it, yeah. What's the beginning of verse 6 say? Act according to your wisdom. What does that mean? What is David saying to Solomon? What does Solomon at 21 already possess?
Wisdom.
Does David tell him, this is how you're going to do it, this is how I want him murdered? He doesn't. He tells him what to do, but he doesn't tell him how to do that, right? For great leaders, leaders want to know, what mountain do you want me to go climb? That one. Great. I'll figure out how to get up the mountain. Let's just make sure that we're after the same goal and that we're pursuing the right thing. But I don't need to be babied and spoon-fed every step up the mountain. Great leaders don't need that. They need the goal. Okay, there's a North Star. Run really hard that way. Okay? But they don't need micromanagement. Solomon exudes, apparently at 21, wisdom already. And David recognizes that. So David says, hey, you need to deal with this problem, but I'm not going to tell you how to do it. You're wise enough to figure this out on your own, right? Why is that important, knowing about what's about to happen to David? If David had told Solomon exactly what to do and exactly how to do it, what happens after David's dead? Exactly. He can't figure it out for himself. If he's constantly spoon-fed every answer by his dad, then he's going to fail. David's telling Solomon, you don't need me. I'm just telling you a couple things that are going to need to get dealt with, but you have the ability as king to figure this out on your own and the people that you're going to surround yourself with. So he's uplifting Solomon's God-given qualities and affirming those. Do you see that? That's brilliant of David, okay? Be a man, walk with God, use the wisdom that God has given you to rule over Israel. Okay? Deal with Joab, act according to your wisdom. But, verse 7, show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite. This was the guy that was the old dude that David said, hey, come with me. And when he was on his way out of town when Absalom was trying to rebel, and the guy said, man, look, dude, I'm old. Like, I don't have those kind of legs anymore. David invited him back into the kingdom when he came in. He's like, man, I'm old. Let me just stay here. He says, man, he's like, I never took that as a shun. Solomon, you don't take it that way either. It's no big deal. Okay. Verse 8, he says, behold, there is with you Shammai. You remember Shammai, the cursing mooner? That's Shammai. And he says, man, you're going to need to deal with him. It was he who cursed me with a violent curse. I don't know what the difference between is a regular and a violent curse, but apparently he used a lot of four-letter words. And David says, I ain't having it. Okay, with a violent curse on the day I went out to Mahanaim. But when he came down and see me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death by the sword. I will not put you to death by the sword. However, verse 9, do not let him go unpunished. So Solomon, I didn't promise that you wouldn't kill him by the sword. I just promised that I wouldn't. So Solomon, in your wisdom, deal with him. And Solomon's going to, he's taking notes. These are the wishes of my father. This is how he wants to handle these affairs. I have freedom as to how I do that. But this guy may need to get killed. And you're going to see Solomon deal with every one of these. It's brilliant. Okay. So David gives, I think, some great instructions. Be a man. Okay, father to son, be a man. Walk with God. Solomon, you have wisdom. These are the things that a father is affirming in his son. There's nobody else that can do that. So you see the number one quality that Solomon is known for throughout the rest of the scripture, obviously, is his wisdom. And David affirms that in him. So he gives his son an anchor, solid footing to stand on. Guys, his parents, remember that. You have the ability to put wind in the sails of your kids like nobody else can, okay? My kids are desperate, in a very positive way, to know what I think they're good at, for me to affirm their gifts, their talents, their abilities, whatever they may be, God-given or that are spiritual gifts or what have you, or just natural abilities, right? They want to know that they're good at something. They want to know that I'm proud of them. They want to know that I love them, and that creates security in kids. So I've been told that kids need to know three things. They need to know you love them, they need to know you're proud of them, and they need to know I see that you are good at math, running, building sailboats, whatever, right? But they need to know, yeah, okay, I'm good at this. This is a unique skill set that I have. So as you think through parenting, those are just three things that kids need to hear from mom and dad, okay? So now, deal with Shammai in verse 8 and 9, and then verse 10, here's where David is now going to pass away. Jordan, keep rolling there.
Then David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. The days that David reigned over Israel were 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. And Solomon sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established.
All right, so this transition is good. David finally obviously speaks his mind, and we now have a clear handoff to Solomon, not the oldest son, but certainly the one that David wished to rule. And Solomon's going to do, in a lot of ways, a great job. He just gets a little bit too big for his britches, if you will. And we're going to see him make some critical errors in his journey. But he's a guy that starts really well and unfortunately finishes poorly, kind of like Saul. They actually have a lot of similarities in their characteristics and their temperament, if you will. Okay.
Mike, why doesn't it list David's age when he dies? Like normally it says, and he lived a year.
Yeah, how old is he? 70. Is he 71? Give me a second. I will tell you. He's 70 and Solomon's 21, okay? Solomon, again, will reign 40 years as well, so just keep that in the back of your mind. It's just you're thinking through, again, the initial start of Solomon, like, man, he's showing characteristics of a guy that is twice his age in terms of wisdom and that sort of thing, okay? So, yeah, David dies at 70. Now, 13, Let's pick up there. Someone pick up in chapter 2, verse 13.
Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggai, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said, "Do you come peacefully?" And he said, "Peacefully."
So Adonijah is the guy that had to play for the throne, right? He's been shot down. Now he's coming back door to Bathsheba, who is Solomon's mom. And she sees this initially as potentially a threat. So she sees something, and he says, no, I come peacefully. I have something to speak to you. Verse 15, keep rolling.
So then he said, "I know the kingdom was mine, and that all Israel expected me to be king. However, the king has turned about and become my brothers. For it was his from the Lord."
So this is, right, that's an odd, like, that situation should have never happened had David ruled better. So this, what we're about to see unfold, he felt like it was his because David failed, again, to speak into that. Keep rolling.
Now I am making one request of you. Do not refuse me. And she said to him, "Speak." Then he said, "Please speak with Solomon the king, for he will not refuse you, that you may bring me
Abishag. Ashbag. I like Ashbag way better, though. That's awesome.
As a wife.
Okay, so hold on. So he's asking for Ashbag, or as we like to call her, Abishag, the Shunammite, as a wife. Okay, who's Abishag? You guys remember? We met her like weeks ago. She was the nursemaid that came and kept David warm. Yeah, she's a chain smoker. Ashbag. She's actually the opposite of that. We know that she's young, she's a virgin, and she's beautiful, but David did not cohabit with her. She was the last woman that David kind of publicly interacted with, and she basically was his nurse, okay, but his concubine as well. Adonijah says, "I want her." This isn't a, "I love her and I'm attracted to her, I want to marry her." What is this move? What is Adonijah doing? We've seen it before.
Political.
Absolutely. So if I can take David's former concubine, and she now becomes my concubine, then what am I saying?
I have power.
I have power, and I am the new king in town. That's exactly what she's doing. Bathsheba's like, "Oh, okay, well, you think she's cute and you want to go on a date. Very well, verse 18, I will speak to the king for you." So she now is going to go to Solomon and say, "Hey, your brother, Adonijah, wants David's old concubine nurse heating pad," is basically what she was for David, "as a wife. What do you think?" So they have this conversation, and Solomon says to her in verse 22, after she makes this request to his mom Bathsheba, "Why are you asking Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask him also the kingdom, for he is my older brother." Do you see what Solomon's able to do in the midst of this? He sees directly through it and says, "Mom, this is not about a wife or whatever. This is about this." And with clarity and wisdom, at 21, he's able to see exactly what that is. "He is my older brother, even for him, Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah." Meaning, he's already aligned himself with all these people for the singular purpose of becoming the king. And that's all this is a move. "I warned him and I told him, go home, leave me alone, and I will leave you alone. And if you don't, then I'm going to mess with you." And that's exactly what Solomon does. So Solomon swore to the Lord, saying, "My God," in verse 23, "may do so to me also if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life." Like, I gave him a chance. I told him to shut his mouth and go home, and we could live in peace. He's clearly trying to start a coup, and I'm not going to have it. So you're going to see Solomon exercise justice, if you will, in his kingship immediately. And at end of verse 24, he says, "Surely Adonijah will be put to death today." So he makes it very clear how he feels about this and tells his mom, "So you can tell Adonijah, no, that's the answer, no, okay?" And there'll be a sword with that no. Now, David tells Solomon to deal with a couple issues, okay? One is obviously Adonijah. He's got to figure out how to do that. Abiathar is this next one. Like, man, this is the guy that was with David as the priest, and then he fled and joined the coup with Adonijah. So what do we do with this guy? Solomon in verse 26, this is how he's going to deal with him. Someone pick up there in verse 26.
And to Abiathar the priest, the king said, go to Anathoth.
Nailed it.
To your estate, thanks. You deserve.
That's where Ashbag lives, by the way.
And Anathoth.
Mm-hmm.
But I will not at this time put you to death because you carried the ark of the Lord God before David my father and because you shared in all my father's affliction. All
right, so what does Solomon say to this guy who's basically at the end of his life a traitor? That wasn't rhetorical. Actually, I was looking for an actual answer. What is David going to do with this guy? Is he going to kill him?
No,
he says, go home, man. You've been faithful to my dad. You made a bad decision at the end of your life, but I'm not going to count that decision against you. You've been faithful to my dad for years. David may have caused this because of the whole issue with Bathsheba and like maybe you're a little ticked at him, so credit given where credit's due. So we're good, man. So he says, so you're seeing Solomon exercise wisdom. Solomon, technically, because this guy was part of the coup, could execute him. And he says, you know what? No. Like, there's no winning that. You've been faithful to my dad. I'm not going to kill you. Go home. Live in peace. We're good. We're fine here. Adonijah, on the other hand, seems to be off asking for a very simple request, right? I just want a wife. The king's in charge of everything. Give me this wife. I think this girl's cute. And Solomon says, uh-uh. That's not what this is about. You're going to die. Okay? Now, the last guy that David said you need to deal with is in verse 28, Joab. Okay? Alex, pick up there.
So King Solomon sent Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada.
Are you in 28?
Oh, that's 25. Now the news came to Joab, for Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. And Joab fell to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar.
All right, so Joab now leaves, and he realizes, man, I've been publicly connected to this coup. I didn't follow Absalom, okay, when he left, but I did follow the second coup with Adonijah. So he runs and takes hold of the horns of the altar, the actual altar of the Lord outside the tabernacle, okay? It was told that King Solomon and Joab had fled there, and he tells Benaiah. Benaiah is his new, like, minister of justice, if you will. And he says, man, you need to go deal with him. But I came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, thus says the king in verse 30, come out. But the king said, no. But he said, no, I will not. And Benaiah brought the king word saying, man, Benaiah is hugging the altar and won't get off it. You know, you still want me to kill him. It's like, man, if he doesn't want to get off the altar, then kill him at the altar. So I told you that I would have to deal with this. So the king said, do as he has spoken and fall on him and bury him. In verse 31, that you may remove from me and from my father's house the blood which Joab has shed without cause. So, verse 34, Benaiah goes back, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and fell upon him and put him to death, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. So Joab is killed by Benaiah on the altar. So he thought he was on base, and Joab says, I'm on base. And Benaiah says, no, you're not. You're dead. So he dies. So we're seeing again, just Solomon execute justice. And then in verse 36, Shimei, the cursing mooner, David said, deal with him. How do you want to deal with him? Solomon's going to choose to be gracious again. He says, build for yourself, in verse 36, a house in Jerusalem and live there. And do not go out from it to any place. Okay? Build a house, but you're on house arrest. Okay? So you got a ball and chain on your foot, right? And electrical fence. And if you pass outside that boundary, I'm going to get notification on my GPS, so don't do it. If it happens, and it's not just house arrest, if it will happen that the day that you cross over the brook Kidron, meaning you can walk all around Jerusalem, not in just your house, but you can't cross over the eastern edge of Jerusalem, the Kidron Valley, and then go up and over the Mount of Olives, you can't leave town, okay? So it's not that bad of a deal. It's not like he's sitting in his bedroom all day, right? He can be in Jerusalem, he just can't leave town. He said, if you leave town, certainly, verse 37, you shall surely die. Your blood shall be on your own head. It's your choice. If you do this, it's your choice, it's your decision, and you're going to die. So sure enough, Shimei says, man, this is good. Verse 38, as my lord the king has said, your servant will do. Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. He built a house, lives in Jerusalem, and says, thank you very much. The problem is, in verse 39, two of his servants run away, and he decides he's going to go chase after them. It's been a ton of time. Surely Solomon's forgotten about this. So he chases after his servants. Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath. So he goes all the way over to the Philistine coast where his servants apparently fled to, brings them back. Solomon hears about it and says, dude, you're a doofus. I told you if you fled, I would execute justice. And sure enough, he does. Verse 46, read that. All right, so we're seeing three different dudes, all of whom are ultimately killed by Benaiah, okay, at the hands of Solomon. So different means, same end for all three guys. They all end up dying. Joab, Adonijah, thank you. There's too many A's in David's family. I can never remember them all. And then finally, Shimei, okay? He tries to extend grace where he can. They abuse grace, and then you get law, and they got it, okay? So what I want you guys to see is just the beginning of Solomon's reign is this young 21-year-old man commissioned by his son, or his father rather, to be a man full of wisdom, and we're going to see that put on display, and essentially here in chapter 3, even more so. So he's doing great so far, okay? Chapter 3, verse 1, here is a hint of things that are to come.
Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the law around Jerusalem, and the wall around Jerusalem.
All right. What's Solomon do? 3, verse 1.
Marries a foreign woman.
Marries a foreign woman. Why? The text tells you exactly why. Yeah, what does that mean? What's an alliance? Yeah, for what? What are you exchanging?
Peace,
right? I'll marry your daughter, Pharaoh, okay? And we'll live in peace together. So you've got skin in the game. You don't want your daughter to die, right? So she's going to live with me. I'll take care of her. I don't necessarily love her. She's a bargaining chip. So yeah, I'll bring her into my kingdom and all the wacky gods that she worships, right, that we just got through studying at church and through our text. Like, she worships all those gods just like her dad does. But now you've got peace. So, maybe one or two or 15 or 100 or 1,000 wives is okay, right, if that brings me peace in the land. And that's what Solomon's after. He's trying to establish his kingdom. David lived in constant turmoil, right, and had to put down these skirmishes. At the end of his life, David has put those down, and we saw that in kind of his Camelot season. Solomon's trying to establish that firmly and say, man, let's ink a deal, let's make a peace treaty, and instead of going before the UN, this is how they did it. You take one of my daughters for yourself. By the way, Solomon's going to get paid a sweet dowry for this. He's going to take care of the king of Egypt, and they're going to live in peace. So on the surface, this seems like a great deal, okay? Knowing what we know about Solomon, what's the problem with this? He does. He likes the ladies to 1,000, 700 wives and 300 concubines. 300 wives, I forget. We're going to see that here mentioned. So he's got 1,000 women in his house. So, and we're going to see the end result of this. What he's doing, okay? It's a mess. Yeah, exactly. How do you keep up with them? How do you even remember their names? Like, I have a hard enough time not calling my children the dog's name, right? And I only have 3 of them, and they all get called Tucker at some point. So, sorry, Ella. I mean, Madison. Gosh, what is your name? And then my wife is in the mix as well. They get it all. So, it's bad. So we're seeing a glimpse of what's to come in Solomon's life, or a glimpse, if you will. Verse 2, the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. So the high places, we're going to find out in the next couple of verses, is in Gibeon, okay, in verse 4. That's where the tabernacle was, right? They brought the ark back. David brought that back because that was a value to him, right? That was the lucky rabbit's foot that caused blessing. So he takes the ark. But the tabernacle is an old beat-up Coleman tent that's 400-plus years old. He doesn't want anything to do with that, so he leaves that. But Solomon goes there to worship, and we're going to see it's pretty amazing. Verse 3, read that.
Solomon showed his love for the people by walking according to the instructions given him by his father David. Except that he offer sacrifices and burn incense on the high places.
So we've seen just this concept of high places before. What are those again? Remind me. In the book of Judges specifically, we saw a lot talked about of the high places. What was worshipped on the high places?
Usually Baal and Asherah.
Yeah, okay. So these are, again, they're mountaintops or whatever. And generally in Baal worship or Ashtoreth or whoever you were worshiping, they would worship on the high places and worship their gods. Now, what Solomon is doing is saying, no, we're not going to worship Baal, we're not going to worship Ashtoreth, we're going to worship God on the high places, though. So it's kind of this mix. So his heart's right, but God would prefer you worship me in the tabernacle. High, low, or otherwise, it doesn't matter, worship me there. But the tabernacle's disjointed, so that's not happening. But he does right in that, man, he's walking with the Lord, right? You see it there. He starts great. And in verse 4, I mean, golly, look at this, the ferventness of his heart.
The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices. That was the most important high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar.
1,000 burnt offerings. Does that tell you how much stuff Solomon inherited from his dad? It tells you a little about his heart for God as well. So yeah, Leviticus chapter 1, let's talk about burnt offerings. He gives you 1,000. Like, okay. And then, this is why. This is an amazing story. So he's coming before God with humility, with fear, with the reality of the task before him. And that's why he does this. And God speaks to him in verse 5. Joe, pick up there.
In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night. And God said, ask what you wish me to give you.
Can you imagine that from God? Joe, here's a blank check. You fill it out. You ask whatever you want, and I will grant it to you. That's the idea. 1,000 burnt offerings, and God says, Solomon, anything you want is yours. I mean, come on. As a 21-year-old male, at the prime of your life, what are you going to ask for knowing that God's going to give it to you? I mean, you talk about genie in a bottle, here it is, and this is what Solomon asks for. Joe, pick up there in verse 6.
And Solomon said, you have showed great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according to as he had walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart towards you, and you have reserved for him this great loving kindness, and you have given him as a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day.
So he says, God, you've been amazing to my dad, to me, like you have shown, has said, love. I mean, he says that over and over, you're amazing. Verse 7, keep rolling.
Now, Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in places of my father David. Yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in.
What does that mean? I do not know how to go out or how to come in. I don't have any experience. I don't have the first clue how to be a king, God. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm 21 years old. My dad says I have some wisdom. He's affirmed me as the king. And I'm grateful to be here. But I don't know how to rule these people. I don't know what to do. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who are too many to be numbered and counted. I mean, we literally at this point have millions, right? So, verse 9, Joe, here's what he asked for.
So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours?
So what's he asked for? Wisdom. He's wise enough to know that he's an idiot. That's brilliant, right? I don't know what I don't know, right? I don't know how to be king. Yeah, I'm wise, and yes, I have some discernment, but Lord, this is a whole new arena, a whole new ballgame. I am now charged with leading millions of people. I don't know what I'm doing. God, give me wisdom. At 21, are you asking for wisdom if God gives you a blank check? I'm not. I know for sure I'm not, right? But Solomon has the wherewithal and the godliness at this point of his life to realize what he needs, and that is brilliant. Katie, you had a thought?
What is, sounds dumb when I say it out loud, but like, what is wisdom? Because he's wise, but then he does a lot of things that
end
in chaos.
Yeah. I've heard it said the difference between knowledge and wisdom is knowing, knowledge is knowing what to do, if you will, and wisdom is knowing not just the what, but how, and being able to execute what you know to be true and carry that out and put it into action. It's not just from the head. It's heart and hands, if you will, as well. Yeah, that doesn't mean that his heart's perfect. So he has wisdom, but his heart's going to get pulled away from the Lord later on in life. And really, in some ways, we see that early on, but it's going to get worse and worse over time to where he knows what to do, but he's not doing it. So that's what ultimately is going to kill Solomon. And it's going to lead him to, in chapter 11, we'll see the ultimate downfall, what exactly that is. And it won't come as any surprise to you guys what it is, right? But 21 years old, he asked God for wisdom. Verse 10, how about this? It was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon asked this thing. Like God's like, man, I could not have had you ask for something better than this. And watch what God does. Katie, this is amazing. Read 11. All right, so because you weren't selfish and asked for money or long life or all the heads of your enemies on a platter, Solomon, what you've asked is good. I'm going to give it to you. However, or not however, in addition, verse 13.
I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days.
What does God know about Solomon's heart? What did Solomon want to ask for? All those things, because he's human. Yes, I want money. Yes, there's a part of me that wants fame. Like, yeah, that's appealing, God. However, when push came to shove, Solomon said, I need to ask for the right thing, which is wisdom. And he had the wisdom to ask for wisdom, right? And God says, you know what? I'll give you the desires of your heart. And as long as what's below the surface doesn't grow slower than what grows above the surface, you'll be able to sustain both of these. So I will give you money. I will give you fame. I'll give you power. As long as you keep walking with me, those will balance each other out accordingly. If you don't, it's all going to come crashing down. And he tells them that. If you walk in my ways, verse 14, keeping my statutes and commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. It will be good. You'll get what you didn't ask for, and you're going to get what you did ask for. It can be a great relationship. Okay, beautiful in Solomon's, you know, his walk with God, if you will, at this young age. Okay, it was a dream. He awoke, came to Jerusalem in verse 15, stood before the Ark of the Covenant, offered more burnt offerings, peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. So he is delighted about how God is now administering justice in his kingdom. Okay, now verse 16, here is on display some examples of Solomon's wisdom. Okay, this is a famous one that you probably heard this story. Katie, pick up there in verse 16. All right, so we got an issue. We got two women. We got no witnesses, two sons. One son dies because the mom rolled over and suffocated the kid. And then that mom whose kid died switched the kids in the middle of the night. And the mom that woke up whose kid was taken from her says, man, we got a problem. That's my kid. And we're both saying the alive kid, the living kid, is my kid. And how do we discern? And Solomon has to figure out who's lying and who's telling the truth. And you guys know his answer. The king says in verse 23, then the king said, the one who says the king, is it 23? Yeah, verse, sorry, 24. Give me a sword. So they brought a sword, and the king says now in verse 25, divide the living child in two and give half to the one and half to the other. So it seems like Solomon's saying, look, I don't know. Cut the kid in half and you can both have half, right? Obviously, the idea is that the mom who's truly the mom of the living child will say, absolutely not. Let the kid live and let him at least live with this wrong mom. And that's exactly what happens. Okay, 26. The woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, saying, she was deeply stirred over her son. Oh, my Lord, give her the living child by no means, kill him. But the other said, he shall have be neither mine nor yours, divide him in half. Like, what a ruthless mom. Like, I can't have my kid, you're not going to have your kid either. And Solomon in his wisdom says, give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She is the mother. So just an example of the wisdom that Solomon has.
That doesn't make any sense. If the woman who killed her son wants another son, like, that doesn't make any sense. She took the son to have another one,
right?
And she's willing to let him die.
Yeah.
Like, that seems fake to me.
Her response is a little odd. The response of the true mom is... certainly the emotive response that Solomon was looking for. So,
what kind of wicked human are you to, like, switch your dead kid out with someone else? She's already, like, messed up. You know?
Yeah, but if she's willing to go to that length to get a son, then why would she be like, oh, yeah, cut him in half? Like, that doesn't make any sense. She was willing to literally steal someone else's child because she wanted it so bad, and then she's like, yeah, kill it.
I think it was, like, even at that point, it didn't even matter if the kid lived or died. It wasn't her.
Yeah, and you assume that's the motive if she wants another kid. Maybe it's just spite or anger at this other mom, and there'd be a lot of different layers of the onion going on here. But I'm with you. It seems odd.
It also describes them as prostitutes. I don't know if that has something to do with
it's
it.
It's true. So. Yeah, these are not holy and righteous women, per se.
You also have to think the matter was brought in front of the king. He knows something's going on, and at that point...
Gigs up.
He's going to cut the kid in half anyway. She's just going to do it. It's not my kid. I don't really care. You know?
Yeah, potentially, yeah. So maybe she's just trying to be in agreement with the king so she can get what she wants, or who knows. But yeah, noodle on it. But the point of it is Solomon's wisdom is being put on display, okay? Chapter 4, you're seeing how Solomon administrates his kingdom. Solomon, by the way, is a brilliant administrator. He's a great leader because he understands my kingdom's huge, and I can't sit on my ivory throne, which I haven't made yet, but I'm gonna. Solid ivory, by the way. And administer justice to all these people. I have to have help. And that's what he does. And you're going to see all through chapter 4 just a list of names that are mentioned, right? Verse 2, these were Solomon's officials. Azariah, the son of Zadok, the priest, who's the first guy on Solomon's staff. A priest. He gets a pastor on his staff, okay? Good move, okay? Verse 4, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the army. Good choice. Yeah, Benaiah was with David. He's one of David's mighty men. Benaiah is the guy that executed justice on the three guys in the chapter that we saw previous to this. He is loyal to David, and he is loyal to Solomon. Benaiah is bad, okay? Bad, good, bad, okay? Then he gets Zabdab, the son of Nathan, a priest, the king's friend. He gets a counselor. He gets a guy from Nathan, the son of Nathan, the guy that rebuked David, and says, man, I need some guys with wisdom around me. They can speak truth into my life. And you're a friend and a counselor to me. Come with me. Okay? Yeah.
What was the role of the second person you named for?
Benaiah? Benaiah is over the army. So he's the new Joab in town. Yeah. Okay? Now, here's a sign of one of his bad moves. You get a guy in verse 6 named Abda. You're going to see him named a couple different things. He was over the men subject to forced labor. What does that mean?
Slaves.
Slaves, okay? These are, according to 2 Chronicles, not Israelites. They are captives from other countries that they have done battle with, and they are the forced labor. So 1 Kings, turn to chapter one more in verse 13, chapter 5, verse 13. It says, Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel. It makes it sound like it's Israelites, but 2 Chronicles chapter 8 clarifies and says, no. Solomon never made Israelites slaves. He put them to work, no doubt. I mean, they worked, and you're going to see that. It's one of the reasons that they don't like Solomon is because he made them work so hard, but they weren't slaves. So there was a distinction. What that distinction was, I don't know, between the Israelites who had to work on the temple and do other things, and the forced labor, the slaves from other countries, and what they were forced to do. But Nonetheless, he has forced labor in his country. And this, by the way, is the same dude that was over David's forced labor. So he brings him in and says, yeah, you're doing a great job cracking the whip. Keep cracking the whip. So he brings him in. Okay, so maybe not a great idea. Verse 7, back to chapter 4. Solomon had 12 deputies over all Israel. Why do you think Solomon would have 12 deputies? Right? One for each tribe. Hey, you're governor of Judah. You're governor of Naphtali. So you exercise judgment, right? So he's dividing up and administrating his kingdom. He's wise. Nobody told Solomon to do this. There's no plan as to how to be a king. There's no law written down that you do this. Solomon is wise enough to go, here's how this is going to need to get administrated if this is going to work. So you're seeing a lot of different gifting within Solomon. And the rest of chapter 4 is a list of names of people that are on his staff, guys that he surrounds himself with. Smart, okay? Now, look at verse 20 of chapter 4, and I want you to see how Solomon's leadership affects Israel. Pick up there in chapter 4, verse 20.
The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt.
All right. So verse 20, what does that tell you? What's the condition in Israel right now? It's awesome. It is great to live underneath King Solomon. They're in prosperity. They have stuff. They're at peace with their enemies. Solomon is executing wisdom and justice, right? There's godliness in the land. They're eating. They're drinking. There's no famine. There's no drought. We don't lack anything. Life is great. We've not seen this description of Israel underneath any other king prior to this. So Solomon, in terms of his administrating the people and that sort of thing, is doing it right. Okay, so, and they paid tribute, end of verse 21, to Solomon all the days of his life. And we'll see more on that in a bit. Okay, so that's called taxes. They're giving him tribute, forced tribute, both internally and externally. And we'll see that here in a bit. End of verse 24, he had peace on all sides around him, every side. So he's not dealing with Egypt, the Philistines, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan. None of the surrounding countries are giving him grief. He's made peace treaties with all of them. Man, Israel would die for this today, right? Just to be at peace with their neighbors, and they can't have it. Judah and Israel, verse 25, lived in safety, every man under his vine and fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Man, that is a great description. What does it mean to live underneath your vine and your fig tree? What was your vine? Your grapevine. Wine, abundance, growth, okay? The fig tree, it's a picture of land flowing with milk and honey. Figs are sweet, right? That's they had abundance. It was sweet to live underneath Solomon all the days of his reign. So for 40 years, this was the way that they lived. It was great, and it's going to get better, the description of Israel will, in terms of how abundantly they were blessed, okay? Absolutely amazing. Okay. Verse 9, here's a little bit, or 29 rather, about Solomon's fame. Kyle, pick up there in 29.
And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all other men.
Stop there. He was wiser than all other men. I forget if it's here. I think it's later on. It says that Solomon is the wisest man that's ever lived on the face of the earth. Like, that's insane. So he prayed for wisdom, and God gave him it in spades to the degree that nobody before and nobody after had the wisdom that Solomon did. Now, that wisdom didn't fix a heart that wasn't completely devoted to God, but he had wisdom. Okay, to the point in verse 34, men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. They came, kings came, to sit underneath Solomon and say, give me Proverbs, teach me Ecclesiastes, give me wisdom, just impart some of your knowledge. He's like the you know, the Buddhist that's out in the middle of the, you know, whatever, standing on a rock that people are making, like, life jaunts to, right? Verse 32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were over 1,000, right? So he's just spewing wisdom and knowledge. So you wonder why things are so great, okay? Yeah, and he can play guitar, apparently, so, and write songs.
Who were all these people in reference to his wisdom? Obviously, it's saying he's wiser than all of them.
Yeah.
Like, these, Ethan and Calcul, like, are these...
foreign kings. The Queen of Sheba in Africa is going to come and visit him in a couple chapters just to hear his wisdom. So, like, literally, all over the known earth. We're going to see Solomon's, like... his trade routes, he builds a navy. I mean, he's taking boats to Spain to go get stuff. I mean, it's he is known. So all over the northern part of Africa, all through the Mediterranean Sea, Solomon travels there. I mean, it's his fame is spreading wide. So I don't know exactly where these guys are from, but it's pretty impressive.
Mike, don't we have other ancient literature that parallels Solomon?
I don't know. That's a great question.
I could have swore that, like, Solomon is either being cited by other ancient people or he is citing them.
Interesting.
And so we can see that he's just widespread throughout the entire community.
See what you can find. That'd be fascinating just to see that. So
there's, like, legend stories of Solomon saying that he has, like,
power. Yeah. I mean, Solomon is Paul Bunyan. But he's legit. He's actually Paul Bunyan. His ox is really that big, and so is his axe. So, you guys know who Paul Bunyan is, right? You went to school. Okay, good. Yeah. I make Alamo references. I'm like, nobody took Texas history in California, Mike. You can't, they don't, you know. Possibly, but probably not. So, yeah. Chapter 5 now, we're going to see the beginning of Solomon's desire to build a house for God. Okay, and this is how he executes it. 5:1, let's pick up there.
Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon when he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father. For Hiram had always been a friend of David.
All right, so you remember Hiram, king of Tyre, he always helped David, gave him wood, and we're going to see the same, had good relationships with him. So Solomon's going to continue this great relationship. Now, Hiram is in Lebanon. Lebanon has trees. Israel does not. Israel has rocks. Solomon, to build the temple, needs wood, and he needs supplies. So Hiram is going to be his boy. Okay.
Olive trees.
They do have olive trees, which apparently are not real good for building stuff. This guy has cedars, and that's what he wants. Okay, and he tells Hiram in verse 5, "Behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, will build the house in my name.'" Here's my struggle with the temple, right? If we take this as a negative thing that Solomon wasn't supposed to build, how did Solomon hear from David what he was supposed to build? A house. And after David's dead, he said, God told my father David to build a house. Now, in addition to that, we got not just a house, but we got a legacy, a whole different kind of house. But God still wants me to build a house. And God's actually going to indwell this house that Solomon builds. He's going to live there. The Shekinah glory of God's going to show up. So whether this is an issue of, hey, Israel says, I want a king, and God says, no, you don't want a king, I'm your king. And they said, no, we really, really do. And God relents and says, okay, well, I'll use the king, but it's just not the best. You guys figure it out. But Solomon still felt compelled to build this house for God. Now, maybe it's because his mansion, Solomon's personal mansion, was so fat that he realized, God can't live in a tent, this is embarrassing, so let's build God a house. I don't know, but for whatever... You can see exactly how Solomon interpreted 2 Samuel verse chapter 7, the Davidic covenant. Yes, it's a house, an enduring legacy, but it's also a physical home for God that Solomon feels compelled to build. David did the blueprints, took him to the architect. It's all laid out. David has done all the groundwork. Solomon's just going to execute it, okay? Hiram, king of Tyre, verse 10, gave Solomon as much as he desired of cedar and cypress timber. So this is not a give. He expects something in return. Now, they've got a great relationship, but when you've got to float timber down the Mediterranean or however you get it there from Lebanon, that was believed as to how they did it, or maybe down the Jordan River. It's a lot of work for Hiram. He's expecting payment, and Solomon's going to pay him. And I'll show you how here in a bit. Okay. Verse 13, the forced labor that we talked about, 30,000 men. Verse 15, Solomon had 70,000 transporters. These are guys that are bringing wood from Lebanon down to Israel. 70,000. And 80,000 hewers of stone. These are stonemasons. 80,000 to build the temple. Does that tell you how grandiose this thing is? I mean, you watch somebody building a house these days. You take maybe all the different trades or whatever. You may have 40 people that touch a house between framers and sheetrockers and electricians and drywall and cabinets or whatever that, you know, ultimately are going to be in there building it. Solomon's got literally well over 100,000 hands, and this is going to take 20 years to build. 20 years. Okay? It's 966 BC when Solomon starts this project. 961 BC. It's going to be finished in 941 BC. 20 years. And he's had that many people building it.
Is the payment to Hiram being verse 11? Or is that something different?
Yes, some. And there's more coming, more that's disturbing, if you will. Okay. Yep. Yes. I have it right here in front of me. Maybe tomorrow. We'll see if we can get there today. But yeah, I got a picture. I was there. I took it when Solomon built it. I am that old. Yeah, exactly. Just kidding. Verse 16, besides Solomon's 3,300 chief deputies who were over the project, these are just the guys that are... These are the foremen. You have 3,300 foremen, right, that oversee the work. Like, this is an insane amount of people, okay? 6 verse 1, it came about in the 418th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, which is in 1446 BC. Sorry, it's 966. I said 961. 966 BC, temple construction begins, okay? It says the house of God at the end of verse 1 began being built. Okay, so 6 in moving forward is all the building of the temple all the way to chapter 8, which is the dedication of the temple. So there's a couple things I want to show you just in the midst of this that some of them are a bit of a head scratcher. Okay, so Solomon's going to rebuild this temple, right? Chapter 7, verse 13, Hiram, king of Tyre, was the guy that was the king. This is a different Hiram, 13. It says, now Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre, which is even more confusing because it's Hiram from Tyre. He's just not Hiram, king of Tyre. He was a widow's son from the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. So there's this guy named Hiram who lives in Tyre, but he's from the tribe of Naphtali, okay, somewhere. He was filled with wisdom and understanding and skill for doing the work of bronze, so he became King Solomon, He came, goodness, to King Solomon and performed all his work. This guy is the designer of the temple. What is the problem when you bring in... Now, he's got roots to Israel, but he's a Phoenician. Okay, he lives on the coast. He lives in Tyre, in Lebanon. This guy is the chief designer of the temple. Why would that be a problem? It's going to look like a pagan temple. See also verse 15. Now, this wouldn't mean anything to you and I, but he fashioned 2 pillars of bronze, 18 cubits long. All these pillars are pagan in terms of where they would come from. So you're syncretizing. Yeah, we're going to bring in the ark, and we're going to bring in the lampstand and the table of showbread, but we're also going to have these things that are marks of pagan temples. So what is Solomon ultimately trying to do with his house of God? He's syncretizing it a bit, but he's trying to make it bigger and better than every other house. So they're trying to compare him. So, by the way, when you go to Israel and you go see the synagogues that are built, the houses of worship for Jews, you see the syncretistic stuff. And you would take the people that built the really cool floors, right? They would have those mosaic floors when the tiles are literally like the size of a penny, and they would be the size of this room. And they would build a floor, and they would build designs into them and pictures and stories. the more syncretistic they got, the more you would see elements of pagan worship in there. And there's a house that we go to, or a synagogue called in Bet Alpha, the house of Alpha, the god Alpha, the Greek god. And the floor has been completely excavated. The original mosaic floor that's 2,000 years old is pristine and got left under rubble and is perfect. And as you as they excavate it, you see it's all these, in this house of worship, all these Greek gods, worship of all this outside stuff that they put into their floor. It's fascinating, right? So the syncretism happening even early on with Solomon. There's nothing pagan about a pillar per se. It's not evil. However, he's borrowing from the cultures around him in a way that is pagan in some regard. Okay, so this outsider designs it. Okay, not necessarily, but it's a sign of what's to come. And you start adding up the pieces, and you see where it's. I'm showing you the trajectory of where Solomon's headed. So
it's kind of a thought in my head, but you have 100,000 workers, foreign workers, but you have Israel numbering probably in the 4 to 5 million citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that if it's your temple, you would want to build it. I mean, we don't go to LA and pull builders from LA to build our skyscrapers in downtown Fresno.
Yeah.
We build from people here in Fresno.
Yeah.
So,
they worked on it, and we're going to see that. They do some work, for sure. But I think part of it is some of this work is just awful. Like, brickwork is awful. Like, nobody wants to do that.
But if this is built to the Lord, it's your company, it's your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, isn't he also just doing the furnishings, or is he designing the whole
thing? This guy seems to be designing the whole thing. He's the chief, architect / designer. Now, David's put the blueprints in. From my understanding, these external pillars are not what David had planned. These are additional.
Yeah.
So it's being tweaked. Okay.
I don't know if it's an NASB translation, but the ESV says the section heading says the temple furnishings.
Gotcha. Yeah, and that's what mine says as well. That's certainly a part of it. But I think he's tweaking some designs. Look at verse 48, by the way, chapter 7. See if this strikes you as odd. Somebody pick up their copy there. 7:48.
So Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of the Lord. The golden altar, the golden table for the bread of the presence, the lampstands of pure gold, 5 on the south side.
All right, pause there. What is he making?
He's remaking the tabernacle.
Why is he doing that? Where's all the stuff that they made in Exodus? Why is he remaking it? What is he remaking it of?
Gold.
See, what was isn't good enough. So I'm going to remake the lampstand. We're not going to have one, we're going to have 10, and they're going to all be gold. And that table is going to be solid gold. And we're going to remake everything that Moses made, because that was bootsy in the wilderness 400 and whatever years ago. I'm going to remake everything. The only thing that Solomon keeps is the ark. Everything else gets remade. It's like, okay, can you worship God on a wood table or a gold table? Yeah, I suppose. But Solomon, why is the table that Moses made not good enough anymore, right? So it's in storage at Daryl's, and they know where it is, right? They know where the ark is. They just choose not to use it. So Solomon remakes everything, okay? Now, it's great, and they make it. Chapter 8, we're done, and they celebrate it, and it is insane. Chapter 8 is literally Solomon's prayer, and it's basically more or less this whole chapter of him telling God how awesome he is. It's amazing. So even in the midst of these, they're still awesome to him, okay? Solomon 8, verse 1, watch what he finally does. Nobody else has done this. Alex 8, 1.
Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes and the leaders of the fathers' households and the sons of Israel to King Solomon in Jerusalem. Bring up the Ark of the Covenant to the Lord of the Lord from the city of David, which is Zion.
All right, so he takes the Ark that David brought in, and verse 4.
They brought up the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent, and the priests and the Levites brought them up.
What's he bring together? The tabernacle and the Ark. And what else? all the stuff, right? They're going back in storage because he remade new ones that are better. Because clearly newer and gold is better than the old ones. But he brings all this stuff back in and finally reunites, right? Reunited, and it feels so good. All this stuff, okay? Verse 5, King Solomon and the congregation of Israel who were assembled with him were with them before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen, they could not be counted or numbered. So we have been without a formal worship place, a tabernacle for however long, and now that they finally like have the ribbon cutting in a sense, which is what chapter 8 is, of the tabernacle, the people are bringing their stuff, the Levites are busy sacrificing animals, so many that they can't even count. And we're going to get a count here in a minute of how many Solomon sacrifices on his own, and it's a lot. So they just stop counting at some point. It's insane. Verse 11, watch who shows up. Read that, Alex.
So that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord.
So who shows up? God shows up. He says, man, okay, like, I didn't ask for this, but it's good. So the Shekinah glory of God, just like over the tabernacle, fills the temple. And Solomon says, the Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud. I've surely built you, verse 13, a lofty house, a place of your dwelling forever. So he quotes, I forget who he's quoting here, but God shows up. This is great. And then in verse 14 and following, Solomon starts praying. 15, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who spoke with his mouth to my father David and has fulfilled it with his hand. All of this moving forward is this prayer. And it's just, God, show up. God, if we blow it, let us come here to confess our sin. Forgive us. This whole chapter is him asking that this place would be a place of perpetual atonement, right? That, God, I know we can't keep you confined here, that you're bigger than a building, but minister to us, walk with us. I mean, literally, we won't read it all, but that is ultimately Solomon's purpose. It's a great, magnificent, God-centered prayer all the way through the end of chapter 8. It is absolutely fantastic, okay? Go all the way to verse 62, at the end of chapter 8. Alex, pick up there and watch now the sacrifice they make on this ribbon-cutting ceremony day.
Now the king and all of Israel with him offered sacrifice before the Lord. Solomon offered for the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered up to the Lord, 20,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. So the king and all the sons of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord.
142,000 animals are sacrificed on opening day. Somebody do the math on that. Like, how many do you have to sacrifice a second to get that done in an 8-hour? Like, that's insane. Like, so do you see Solomon's heart? Like, he is all in. Even 20 years into this thing. So again, we just got 20 years of Solomon's life right there. He's halfway through his reign. But it is amazing, right? So they crank this thing up. God shows up. They offer sacrifice. And you can see the abundance of what they have. And the next couple chapters will begin to paint that, of how big this thing was.
In an 8-hour day, it's 300 sacrifices a minute.
300 a minute. Golly, that's insane. Yes. Yes. We will see when the second temple is built. There are people that were around during this. And as the second temple is built, it's such a shack compared to this mansion that they weep. They're like, oh, you guys should have seen how awesome this thing was. So they will, there's kind of a new and old generation. The new generation, it's the best temple they've ever seen because it's the only temple they've ever seen. But the old generation's like, this thing is sorry. So this is insane. I mean, the furnishings, the gold, the ivory, I mean, everything in it is to the nines. This thing is just, it's insane. And you're going to see the cost it took on the people, what Solomon did. This was not a cheap enterprise. And when Solomon had the cash, he's financially strapped his country to build this ostentatious house for God. When God would have been happy, Solomon just put the tent up, put the ark inside of it, let's worship. You know, I'll show up there too. So he could have done this for $20, or he could have done this for $20 billion, and he chose to go the long route. So Okay.
And it's the cost of human animals to sacrifice just for his own self.
Yeah.
And then also the cost of the sacrifice for the people. Like just that many animals that they have.
Yeah. Yeah. Sacrifice. And what happens when you have that much abundance? What's that called when you just, like, you'll see in, stupid rich, I think is the actual term, you're right. Look at chapter 10, verse 21. I'll just give you an example. All of King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold. Pure gold. He drank from gold, gold only. All the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. None was of silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. Solomon had so much gold that silver was invaluable. Unvaluable. Not invaluable. Insane, right? He's created hyperinflation. So something that should cost a buck cost $1,000 because everybody can pay $1,000 for it. So it's off the charts economically, right? Now, at this point, everybody's doing well, but costs have gone up to where, look, we don't even count the $1 bills anymore. They're useless to us, right? This is a bit of what's occurring, okay? So we'll get more of that tomorrow. I'll show you guys we'll finish the temple, and I'll kind of walk you through some of the pictures. You've seen them before when I showed you the tabernacle stuff, but I'll give you a glimpse of it. And then what Herod turns it into, we've seen as well, but we'll pick up on that tomorrow.
What are dollar bills?
Dollar bills. So things you used to carry in your wallet next to your credit card.
Oh.
Someone asked me that the other day. I don't have a wallet. I have a phone with credit cards in it. I'm like, where do you put your cash? I'm like, what cash? Like, I carry cash.
I just recently got a new wallet. It was like, for a while, I just stuck it on.
Yep.
Yeah.